More deaths and destruction have been reported as the Israeli regime keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery. Palestinians laid to rest the family members of the Hamas political bureau chief who were assassinated in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza. Also in the headlines, Israeli forces have conducted fresh violent raids on occupied Palestinian territories. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. More deaths and destruction have been reported as the Israeli regime keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery. According to Gaza's health ministry, Israeli strikes across the Gaza Strip killed 63 people and wounded 45 more over the past 24 hours. The latest fatalities have pushed the overall death toll in Gaza since October 7 to more than 33,500. In the latest Israeli strikes, at least 8 people were killed in the southern district of Rafah. Another 5 Palestinians lost their lives after Israeli warplanes targeted the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Also, Israeli tanks shelled residential complexes in the Zahra neighborhood north of Nusayrat and damaged homes there. The Al-Shati refugee camp, west of the besieged territory, was not spared, and 5 Palestinians were killed there. Earlier, our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala and gave us the latest about the situation in the war-ravaged strip amid the ongoing Israeli onslaught there.
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces intensified and concentrated their airstrikes and attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip generally and against the northern part on the outskirts of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, basically, as the Israeli fighter jets and the Israeli warplanes carried out several airstrikes against those areas that reached Al-Amal town, which is located, as you know, in the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, and even Al-Mughraga town. They were under heavy bombardments of the continuous and the chronic Israeli airstrikes. In addition to that, the Israeli artillery also maintained its shelling towards those areas. Over the last hour, the Israeli occupation forces and the Israeli artillery shelling targeted the gate of a school that was taken shelter as by the Palestinian evacuees in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. At least 5 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over the attack. In the meantime, 2 other Palestinians were reportedly killed as a result of the continuous and the ceaseless Israeli artillery shelling that is still hitting those areas till this moment as we speak right now. Those parts actually are still subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery shelling. It was a horrific night for the Palestinian people there. In the meantime, the eastern outskirts of the central area of Gaza Strip were subjected to heavy bombardments of the artillery shelling, particularly the eastern part of Deir al-Balah and al-Maghazi refugee camp, as the Israeli artillery shelling and was maintained against those areas amid continuous and heavy gunfire of the Israeli choppers and the Israeli helicopters against those areas.
Palestinian mourners have laid to rest the family members of the Hamas political bureau chief and several others who were martyred in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza. The burial ceremony was held in Gaza City. On Wednesday, 3 sons of Ismail Haniyeh, identified as Hazem, Amir, and Mohammed, were killed after the regime warplanes hit a vehicle in the Al-Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. 4 grandchildren of Haniyeh were also among those killed. It was a targeted attack on the Eid al-Fitr day, which marked the end of the holy month of Ramadan. People in the besieged strip celebrated the occasion in the shadow of the ongoing Israeli genocide. Several Palestinians were in the street at the time of the deadly Israeli strike. Some of them recount the harrowing moments of the attack.
We were still near the school. They were here to visit the families of the martyrs. When we heard the sound of a strike nearby, we went outside to see, and they said it was the children of my uncle Abu Abed Haniyeh. There are bodies and body parts after they targeted the car, and there were 3 missiles from a drone fired by the Israeli forces.
The sons of Ismail Haniyeh, head of the Hamas political bureau, 3 of them were driving in the car. They were there and 3 drone strikes hit. 3 sons of Haniyeh and 3 of their children were hit. Their body parts went everywhere. There are even some remains on our house. We found a hand and a leg. There are body parts anywhere you look.
Ismail Haniyeh reacted to the martyrdom of his family members, saying that their blood will only boost the Palestinians' resolve to resist the Israeli occupation. Meanwhile, a chorus of condemnations and condolences poured in over the Israeli killings. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement condemned the atrocity, calling it a war crime and a barbaric massacre. Yemen's Ansarullah movement said that such sacrifices strengthen the steadfastness of Palestinians against the occupying regime. Lebanon's Hezbollah, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Iraq's Islamic Resistance also offered their condolences to Haniyeh. Iran also condemned the Israeli airstrike, with President Ibrahim Raisi saying that this shows Israel's disregard for all human and moral principles. He said the crime further exposes the savage and child-killing nature of the regime. Separately, Iran's foreign minister said that Israel's criminal actions will speed up the regime's collapse. Charlotte Cates is an international coordinator of Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. She joined us from Vancouver with her take on Israel's targeted killings, including family members of Palestinian resistance leaders and fighters.
The Zionist regime has consistently used assassinations as a mechanism of warfare against the Palestinian people and as a mechanism of genocide, because these assassinations are meant to deny the Palestinian people fundamentally their self-determination through assassinating leaders, through assassinating leaders' families. Right now what we're seeing is this is what the Zionist regime means by negotiating a ceasefire is killing the children and grandchildren of Ismail Haniyeh. And of course, this isn't restricted to Palestinians. The notorious crime that the occupation regime just carried out last week in Syria, attacking the Iranian embassy and murdering people, including Iranian generals and leaders. This is a strategy that the Zionist regime uses in the belief that by engaging in these campaigns of terror, they'll be able to wipe out the resistance or take away the knowledge and leadership that the Palestinian people and the regional forces need in order to resist and win victory. But one thing has been clear throughout this entire history of decades and decades of assassinations and decades of criminal war crimes is that none of this has done anything to legitimize the Zionist nor to crush or kill the Palestinian people and their resistance.
Israeli forces have conducted new raids across the occupied West Bank. They abducted a number of Palestinians in their latest attacks. Our Ramallah correspondent Monica Ndil gives us more details.
We were speaking about Israeli military incursions to Mutul Karim and to areas in Al Khalil, but now we are speaking about Israeli military raids to Tul Karim, to Al-Khalil, to Jenin, to Nablus, to Al-Amari refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as to settlers' aggression in the area near Nablus. So the Israeli forces had, as usual, expanded their military incursions to several areas across the occupied West Bank. In Tul Karim, the Israeli forces stormed the area of Shweke and arrested at least five Palestinians from there, including one former or ex-Palestinian prisoner. In Al-Khalil, the Israeli troops stormed Idna and Beit Umar, attacked Palestinians, raided the homes, questioned the people there. The exact number of the Palestinians who had been detained is not known, those who were arrested in the areas of Al-Khalil. The Israeli forces had also stormed the town of Aurif, south Nablus, and they attacked Palestinians there. They forced their way into the homes away. In addition to Aurif, the Israeli forces stormed the village of Azzoun, east Qalqilia. In the last 4 days, let's say, the Israeli forces had been storming the villages of Azzoun and Jayus almost on a daily basis. A Palestinian had carried out a shooting several days ago, and the Israeli forces are still searching for this Palestinian who carried out the shooting at Israeli soldiers and settlers in an area between Azzoun and Jayus near Qalqilia. And every day the Israeli forces are storming these areas, raiding the Palestinians' homes and questioning them, and they are looking for this Palestinian.
Tensions remain high between Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and Israel since the beginning of the regime's genocidal war in Gaza. Both sides continue to exchange fire along Lebanon's southern border. In the latest attacks, Israeli warplanes bombed several Lebanese villages and towns. Hezbollah also retaliated by targeting Israeli military outposts in the occupied Sheba farms. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier with details.
But they did target several areas in the town of Dhaira. We know that there was an elderly woman who was wounded as a result of the shelling against the town of Dhaira, which was in near some of the houses that are in the outskirts of Dhaira. Dhaira is relatively close to the border. We know also that sirens were sounding in several of the settlements and the iron dome system was activated. We're not sure exactly where Hezbollah hit, but we know from yesterday's operations, Hezbollah basically it decreased the number of operations. We had only two significant operations, basically against the Shabab Farms posts, the occupied Lebanese Shabab Farms post, and another post which is in occupied Palestinian territory on the western side of the border. So this is just part of it, and we have statements coming out from the Hezbollah members of parliament who all went to the border side, saying that they will even continue to support the people who have decided to stay in those towns and those villages, despite the fact that we do have displacement from the ones that are just adjacent to the border. But the rest of the towns are all people either receiving displaced people or people who are still in their houses, and that in itself is considered one of the major blows of the Israelis. The number of displaced people compared to the past that we've had, for example, in 2006, we've always had the people of Lebanon always being displaced from all of South Lebanon. During the occupation, you had hundreds of thousands of people forced to exile or to leave their towns and villages.
Nicaragua has announced the closure of its embassy in the German capital, Berlin. Nicaragua's consular tasks and official businesses in Germany will now be handled by its embassy in Austria. The Central American nation took the move amid its row over Germany's arms sales to the Israeli regime. Last month, the government of President Daniel Ortega filed a case at the International Court of Justice against Germany for giving financial and military aid to Israel and for defunding the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Managua accused the European country of facilitating the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The ICJ held two-day hearings on the case this week. Nicaragua hopes the top UN court would issue provisional measures to stop Germany from arming Israel. Iranians have marked the end of the holy month of Ramadan by performing Eid al-Fitr rituals and taking part in mass prayers. The celebrations this year were overshadowed by the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. Gisumi Shahmadi has more.
Eid, but no Eid, marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan with the same rituals, but definitely not the same festive mood. Iranians observing Eid al-Fitr by taking part in mass prayers as always. Nonetheless, this year, the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza on their minds, and sharing videos of Gaza on an occasion that is one of the most important holidays on the Islamic calendar.
We will always support our brothers and sisters in Palestine. The Zionists should know that they are not alone. All it takes is a word from our leader and we will be ready to fight.
We will always support the Palestinians. We always have. And today, I brought my two daughters as a message to the mothers in Gaza that we will always be there for them no matter what.
This also became the main theme of the leader's Eid al-Fitr address, as he strongly criticized Islamic governments that have not cut ties with and support the Zionist regime.
Eid al-Fitr is supposed to be a happy occasion, but this year Iranians are not happy because of the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
Millions of Muslims celebrate Eid al-Fitr worldwide, marking the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. This year's Ramadan came as Israel's war in Gaza continued unabated and claimed more civilian lives even during the holy month. Fatima Masumi reports from the Iraqi city of Karbala.
Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, which marks the conclusion of the holy month of Ramadan, the month of Allah, the month of the Holy Quran, and the month of prayer and piety. Muslims mark the Eid with mass prayers and gather together for special prayers and contribute financially to charitable causes. The celebration of the Eid emphasizes the values of spiritual upliftment, unity, and generosity towards those who are in need. The holy month of Ramadan holds immense significance in Islam and for Muslims worldwide. The month of fasting also marks the revelation of the Holy Quran to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The birth of Imam Hassan, the second Shia Imam, also falls in this month. So does the martyrdom of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam and the leader of the believers. This year's Eid al-Fitr came amid Israeli-U.S. genocidal war on Gaza. The incessant, devastating war continued to claim civilian lives even during the holy month, with fasting Palestinians losing their lives to Israeli atrocities and barbarism. Palestinians' plight in the war-torn Gaza is the most important issue of the Muslim world today. The war has dehumanized the entire Palestinian population in Gaza and decimated the life there. The Palestinians have sacrificed everything that was dear to them, their children, spouses, mothers, fathers, and their homes, but remain committed to their faith and their resistance to the Israeli occupation. The holy month of Ramadan was not just about fasting, but also about Muslim unity, in particular against injustice. This month, we sympathize with Palestinians in the war-torn Gaza and express solidarity with our brothers and sisters who are enduring the most savage crimes seen in modern history. Fateh Masumi, Karbala.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives. But in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model. Mark Rotenberg is an internationally renowned jurist. He has been heard many times by the Congress and the U.S. Senate for his expertise in the field of the Internet. He is the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the main associations for the protection of privacy.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen. I mean, I think there are some people who have this view. It's our modern life. We'll just all get used to it. I hope it doesn't happen. You see, I hope it doesn't happen because I think such a future will be a digital prison. We will have the experience that people have when they're in a prison.
We abandon a part of our freedoms by accepting to be monitored in our private lives. In the field of surveillance, two viewpoints are nowadays coexisting and competing in the world. Some are rebelling against these violations of privacy in the name of individual freedom, while others consider technological developments as a preferred means of strengthening the security level. The United States, where the public domain may be monitored without any legal authorization, has developed an initiative for the pioneer collective surveillance, the NOLA Project. Citizens are at the heart of this community video surveillance project.
I can watch all 32 cameras at any time from any computer or iPhone. I was really excited when I found out that my crime cameras were linked directly to the cop. It's a new issue that the cops are getting help from private citizens, and I think in New Orleans it's important for the private citizens to become a part of crime fighting. Our police force is tasked. It's declining. We have certain issues that we don't have enough police force and enough eyes on the street.
The hyper-connectivity has enabled a former police officer, Brian Lagarde, to set up a private monitoring system with an unlimited development capacity. All the images captured by the citizens' cameras come together in this management center.
Project NOLA is greatly assisting the local police department because we're bringing citizens together. We're using modern technology, cutting-edge technology, and we're putting all this together where the citizens and the police, they're all combined together. Each one of these cameras, they're hosted on someone's home or on somebody's business. They're not on telephone poles. They're not on public property. And each one of these people are volunteering to host a camera, allow it to connect to their internet connection, where it then flows through into this building where we're able to record it free of charge.
In Europe, it is officially forbidden to film your neighbor's garden. But here in America, not only is this possible, the images may be broadcast on the internet.
Two of us, the two neighbors, we got together and arranged the cameras to point in two directions so that anyone going either direction on the street, we would get a shot of their face. So what you'll notice, this one's this way, and the other camera in my neighbor's house is pointed in this direction. And these are 3-megapixel night vision cameras. They're lit up by IR lights, so at night you can see a little bit of a red glow to them, and they work quite well. These are recorded inside the home, in my case, and Project NOLA, through the internet, has access to both of these cameras.
We can send the video to the responding detectives and police officers instantly. Two people robbed a lady, they beat her up, they took her purse. And what helped the police so much is A, we're able to identify the perpetrators, and B, we have the perpetrator with the lady's purse, and then this perpetrator was actually smiling as he was running. So when he goes to court, he's going to have a very bad time in front of that judge because he was smiling. Of course, they're not going to like that very much. Each one of these cameras, all these 770 cameras that I have around me right now, they can all be used in a court of law for when the bad things happen.
Thank you.
y'all. It's into this morning, and somewhere in here, I go off to work. It's probably an image of us standing outside the house. You'd be able to get their face. I think we're giving up a little bit of liberty, but we gain a lot in security. So it's a balance, and I think we found a pretty happy balance. And here is sort of the big point. We're winning.
The word security is increasingly associated with surveillance. We went to meet one of the world's leading researchers in this field. Sociologist David Lyon, a professor at the University of Kingston, leads the research laboratory of surveillance, where he has studied for 20 years the impacts of surveillance on our lifestyles.
There are questions about some balance or some tension between liberty on the one hand and privacy on the other, or security and liberty. There are various ways in which this debate is located. However, it seems to me that, again, the big questions still need to be asked. The word security is one of the most influential words in the world today, and it is also the least carefully defined. The definition of what is security leaves many, many questions, particularly as the word is frequently associated with national security. What is national security? Whose national security are we trying to protect or maintain? So questions like this, I think, are tremendously important ones.
Now we're going to meet those who think that security does not justify the renunciation of our fundamental freedoms. German engineer Carsten Knoll is an expert in technology. He gives us an appointment in Berlin, the Security Research Lab, his research laboratory on computer security. His company has gained international reputation by exposing the failures of mobile network carriers. He himself has broken the security code of the SIM cards that equip all our phones in order to reveal their failures. Now, if they want to reinforce the security of computer networks, they come straight to him. The science doctor knows very well how you can use these new technologies to encroach on anyone's privacy. And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon. But a week later, on September 11th, 2001, the attacks on America brushed aside this European initiative altogether. In a single day, the scope of the security measures around the world changed entirely. The U.S. president at the time, George W. Bush, signed the Patriot Act, the anti-terrorism law, which established the most ambitious surveillance project in history with the support of Europe.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
The idea of terrorism was distilled into a particular understanding of terrorism, which of course in practice was frequently associated with particular groups. And so that designation came to capture what terrorism was supposedly all about. One of the problems with that is that the ways that surveillance were developed after 9/11 was to use the same kind of cover-all description, terrorism, terrorist, to begin to include other groups as well.
At the heart of the surveillance system post-September 11, a man enjoyed all the attention of the U.S. president on security policy. Now a partner in an influential law firm, Stuart Baker was then the NSA's general counsel and deputy secretary in charge of internal security in the Bush administration. He is one of the implementers of U.S. security ambitions.
I don't think there's any effort or reasonable likelihood that the entire population of the United States could be controlled on pretty much anything. But in many cases, you do have to look at all of the information about the entire population in order to find people who are trying very hard to escape your notice, to try to hide from you. And often it is only when you look at the entire population that the people who are the riskiest, you don't know that they're guilty of anything, but you know that they are riskier than others, can get the attention that they deserve.
Security takes center stage in the U.S. government's policy priorities. From 2001 to 2013, the total intelligence budget gets doubled to reach 40 billion euros. A quarter of it is reserved for the NSA, the eyes and ears of the secret services. The agency's Maryland headquarters are off limits to investigative journalists. The NSA has provided us with official images worthy of a low-grade TV series where the same comedians appear in each plan to give us an idea of the work of 15,000 agents of the site. What is behind this pretense, behind which they can monitor the life of anyone, anywhere in the world? Of those who know about the agency's secret operations, only a few people have broken their silence. In a forest near the headquarters of the NSA, we meet Thomas Drake, a former Navy officer hired by the agency in 2001 to be in charge of the surveillance operations. A few months later, irritated by the processes, he opposes the hierarchy, putting his life in danger.
I confronted my immediate supervisor, the number three person at NSA. I said, "We're engaging in surveillance of Americans on an extraordinarily broad scale without a warrant." And he said, "You don't understand. Everything's different now." The phrase that was used was, "We live in exigent conditions." That means extraordinary means are necessary to deal with a threat. So, and he said, we just need the data. And then he said, "Don't ask any more questions. You don't want to go there." It was more than just a passing threat to me.
After these revelations, Thomas Drake was accused of high treason in 2006. He faced the risk of being sentenced to life imprisonment. After 5 years of proceedings, the charges were dismissed in the absence of evidence.
In 2006, I came under direct investigation by the U.S. government. Why? Because I was disclosing crimes being committed by the U.S. government against its own people in total violation of the Fourth Amendment. All done in secret because the executive decided, you know what? We don't have to have an open and free democracy. We don't need transparency. We will determine in secret what's best for the American people, and we will keep them safe on our terms.
A surveillance state, by definition, means that anything that it surveils is suspicious. Whether or not you're doing anything suspicious doesn't matter. By definition, you're subject to surveillance, which means you're automatically suspicious. And that's the real danger, that everybody is assumed to be suspicious until proven otherwise. It completely flips, even in the United States, what our system of justice is. But you just remember, all this is happening largely in secret. And they're not going to yield willingly. I mean, you see the power elite, okay, those who are in charge, they're not going to give this up lightly. It's a seductive thing to have all this knowledge available, all this data available, just literally at the tips of your fingers. In this case, at a click of a mouse.
In Montreal, Ubisoft has done cyber surveillance over the engine of a video game, Watch Dogs. In this game, smartphones are replaced with firearms. It took 5 years of investigation and hard work for more than 400 developers to create Watch Dogs, a venture far less futuristic than it seemed.
The Limelight.
For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Tuta family had spent a fortune on setting up a pharmacy in Gaza City. It has been in business little more than 2 years when the Zionist regime launched the current genocidal war. When Israel ordered a mass evacuation from the northern part of Gaza on October 13th, the family had no option than to leave. As Zaytun, the neighborhood which the pharmacy was located, had been subjected to extreme Israeli regime violence during previous attacks on Gaza. They went to stay with a relative in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. Back in their pharmacy, they left medical supplies, estimated at $90,000. From those stocks, they just took some blood pressure medication for Fatima, the mother of the family. They stayed with their relatives for more than 50 days. Then, they were uprooted again, this time taking shelter at the European Gaza Hospital near Khan Yunis. They were still at the hospital in late February when they heard of a major Israeli regime offensive against Az-Zaytun. It took a number of days before they learned the terrible news about what happened to the pharmacy. After repeated attempts, Momen Tuta, one of several pharmacies in the family, was able to contact his friend Azam. Azam went to check on the pharmacy and informed Momen that it was completely destroyed. Azam said, everything was gone. It was all burnt out. The family had taken an enormous risk to open the pharmacy in the first place. As well as borrowing money, they sold the 350 square meters piece of land which they owned. All of the family were involved in the business. The siblings, who were not qualified pharmacies, helped with such tasks as marketing via social media and delivering supplies. Before they opened the pharmacy, the family had been in a precarious situation. Fatima was supposed to take medication every day, but she could not afford to. When the family incurred debt to put the children through university, Fatima took less medicine than the prescribed dose so that she could save some money. Of Momen's first thoughts on hearing that the pharmacy had been destroyed was that his mother would no longer have enough medicine. Their story is far from exceptional. For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. According to Press TV, the Zionist regime's relentless aggression against the Gaza Strip has now stretched over 6 months and shows no sign of abating, despite international calls for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime launched the war on Gaza on October 7th after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged the surprise operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying entity in response to the Israeli regime's decades-long campaign of violence against Palestinians. At that time, the Israeli regime said attacking Gaza had two goals: eliminating Hamas and bringing back the hostages taken by the resistance group to Gaza. None of them have been achieved so far. About 130 of the 250 Israeli captives taken during Al-Aqsa Storm are still in Gaza after a provisional truce deal in December saw the exchange of a number of prisoners between the two sides. The conflict in Gaza has taken a devastating toll on Palestinians, with over 33,200 people, including 13,800 children, having lost their lives in 180 days of war, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health. On top of that, around 76,000 people have been wounded, about 4 out of every 100 people in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said recently some 1,000 children in Gaza have lost one or both of their legs. A record-breaking 176 UN staff members and 6 foreign aid workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. The Israeli regime army has killed the largest number of journalists of any modern conflict and abducted more than 24. More than 140 journalists have been killed during the 6 months of the war in the Israeli regime's military raids, bombardments, and missile attacks across the Gaza Strip. The humanitarian situation in Gaza has worsened day by day as the Israeli regime army continues to prevent aid from reaching the region, resulting in starvation being utilized as a tactic of warfare, as over a million are at risk of starvation, with international groups warning of an imminent famine. At least 27 Palestinians have already died from malnutrition and dehydration, according to international NGOs. More than 80% of Gaza's population, over 1.9 million Palestinians, have been intentionally displaced as the Zionist regime military ordered Palestinians to go south from the start of the war. Some 1.4 million people are believed to be sheltering in Rafah, a small city on Gaza's southern border with Egypt, which is being bombarded by the Israeli forces every day as they have left no safe zone for the Palestinians to live. The estimated $18.5 billion in damage has affected public service infrastructure, resulting in 26 million tons of debris and rubble. Over 290,000 housing units, equivalent to 62% of all homes in Gaza, have been damaged or destroyed by the war, leaving more than a million people homeless. Only a fraction of hospitals, 10 out of 36, are operational following severe damage, leading to overwhelming strain on their limited resources. Ashifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in Gaza, has been left severely damaged and burnt after enduring a relentless two-week-long siege. The compound, which witnessed the loss of at least 400 lives and the arrest of hundreds, now faces a dire situation. With an acute shortage of medicine and healthcare professionals on the brink of exhaustion and starvation, the majority of patients in Gaza are unable to receive the treatment they desperately need. The scarcity of resources has forced medical teams to carry out operations and amputations without the availability of anesthetics, further exacerbating the already dire circumstances. On March 6, South Africa filed an urgent request with the International Court of Justice and requested for additional provisional measures issued on January 26. In January, the ICJ ordered the Zionist regime to refrain from any acts that could fall under the Genocide Convention and ensure its troops commit no genocidal acts against the Palestinians in Gaza. Israel described the genocide allegation as baseless. Recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling for a halt to all arms sales to Israel and for the regime to be held accountable for possible war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Moreover, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution last month demanding an immediate ceasefire for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The resolution is the first to be approved by the Council after three previous attempts during the past 5 months of war were vetoed by the U.S. regime. Meanwhile, during the month of war, protests around the world have been held in support of Palestine, calling for an immediate ceasefire and halt to arms sales to the Zionist regime.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Part 1.
In the 1990s, a big crime was committed in Southeast Europe, which reminded the world of the Middle Ages. The Bosniaks were killed by other groups in former Yugoslavia because they said no to the formation of Serbia and its independence, and more importantly, because they were Muslims. Genocide was committed against Bosniaks in order to cleanse the Green Continent of Muslims and consign Islam into oblivion forever. But a different fate awaited the Bosniaks. Prior to the arrival of Islam in Bosnia, the Bogomils were United Christians and were resisting the preachers of the Roman Church. In the 11th century, merchants from Khorasan entered this region for business. Their behavior, which was based on their Islamic thought, led to the introduction of Islam in this region, where people accepted the religion and embraced it. This is Sarajevo, the capital city of Bosnia and Herzegovina that shares borders with Serbia and Croatia. Bosnia and Herzegovina is a country which has survived hundreds of years of genocide and has managed to keep Islam alive by itself in Europe. One of the existing Islamic symbols in Sarajevo is a water-drinking place called Sakohane, which is located in an old neighborhood of the city. It is said that a total of 72 such places had been built in Sarajevo in memory of the 72 companions of the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein, who were martyred during the Battle of Karbala. Currently, one of those places has turned into a cultural symbol of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and its capital city. Sarajevo also has a library which is regarded as a hub of history books on the Balkan Peninsula. The Gazi Husrev Beg Library, dating back to 500 years ago, has more than 10,000 books and collections of manuscripts in Arabic, Ottoman, and Persian. At midday in the summer, Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, and his wife were shot and killed by a young Serbian man in Sarajevo. The murder ignited the First World War that led to an end to Ottoman rule on Bosnia and put it under Austro-Hungary control. Following the Second World War, the competition between communism and liberalism resulted in the formation of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia by the Balkan countries, and that marked the beginning of a new era for Muslims in this region. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia witnessed changes as well, and various regions there declared independence. Slavs in Slovenia, Croats in Croatia, and Muslims in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But the formation of a Muslim-majority country that opposed the establishment of a Serbian government was not to the liking of European leaders. A day after a referendum on independence, a plot was hatched that caused the genocide of Muslims in this region. The war made the Bosnian people try to revive their Islamic identity, and they were divided into military battalions to reach their goal and defend Islam and humanity. People in this country have gone through what could have brought an end to their life and left only memories from them. But instead, the same path presented them the beginning of a new life, and the secret behind that was the unity and resistance they had. People in Bosnia give much importance to Islamic rituals. Muslims in this country are especially very enthusiastic about religious festivities such as Eid al-Adha, Eid al-Fitr, and the fasting month of Ramadan.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.